This is Richard M. Stallman speaking at the University of Cincinnati, Cincinnati, Ohio, on the 24th of January, 2000. Introduction by Bradley M. Kuhn of the Cincinnati GNU Linux Users Group.
Hi everybody, my name is Bradley Kuhn. I've been asked by the University of Cincinnati and the Cincinnati GNU Linux Users Group to give a brief introduction of our honored speaker this evening. Before I introduce the speaker, I would like to first thank both Cincinnati GNU Linux Users Group and the ECCS department of the university to make this event possible. And the sign-in sheet for those of you in the seminar class who are supposed to sign in, to pass this around, make sure you have to give the doctor a slip so you guys get your credit for your class. So, Mr. Stallman has dedicated his career to ensuring that computer users can accomplish any computing task with only free software. A number of prestige organizations have honored Mr. Stallman's efforts. In 1990, he was awarded the MacArthur Foundation Fellowship. In 1991, Mr. Stallman received the Grace Hopper Award from the Association of Computing Machinery for his early work on the Emacs editor. In 1996, he received an honorary doctorate from the Royal Institute of Technology in Sweden. In 1998, along with Linus Torvalds, he received the Electronic Frontiers Foundation's Pioneer Award. Thus, it is an honor and a privilege for me to introduce to you our distinguished speaker this evening. I would like to introduce the President of the Free Software Foundation, Mr. Richard M. Stallman.
I never quite understand what we're applauding, but people do it, so I figure I better join in. Well, I'm going to be speaking about the GNU project and the free software movement, how we developed a free operating system and nobody knows it. But more important, I'm going to be talking about issues of politics and society, what kind of society we should be living in, what kind of social rules we want to live under. Most of the time when people think about the questions of what the rules should be for using software, they're usually owners of software companies, and they usually take a completely selfish approach, asking what rules can we impose on the public so we can benefit. Now, I had the good fortune in the 1970s to be part of a software sharing community, a community of programmers where it was normal to share software with everybody. And because of this, I came to look at that same question from a different direction, asking what makes a good community, a good society for people to use computers in? What kind of rules for the use of software make possible a community? And because of this, I reached completely different answers from the ones that the software privateers reach. In this community, you walk by some other hacker sitting at a console and saw something interesting on the screen, you'd say, hey, what is that? Oh, that's the new FUBAR program which we just got from Stanford. It's in the FUBAR directory. So you'd look in that directory and there you'd find an executable that you could run, source code that you could read and study so you could learn how they solved those problems. And then if you, after running the program, you might get ideas. You might find bugs that you wanted to fix. You might find that some feature didn't quite work or wasn't there. Or you might just get ideas for additional features, additional capabilities. Well, you could fix the bugs. You could add the features. And in addition, you might find that there was some piece of the program doing a particular sub-job that was useful in some other project you were working on. So you could just cut that piece out and put it into your program, where it would do another job. We used to call this cannibalization, although it's not quite appropriate because the old program wasn't destroyed by this. So you could use a program not only by executing it, but in all the various ways that a program is useful. And sometimes one program would be developed by one person after another over periods of a decade or more. You could look at growing sort of the way a city grows. And you could look at certain pieces and say, oh, by the style I can tell this must have been written a long time ago. Because nowadays people wouldn't do it that way. You know, conventions change over time. Just as you walk around in some cities and you see old buildings and you realize that was built a few decades ago or a few hundred years ago. And being part of this community, I got a very good feeling. I felt we're all working together to advance human knowledge. We're not working against anybody. We're not trying to hold somebody else back or for some petty goal like beating out somebody else. No, we're working to make humanity better off. But I realized that it wasn't like that for everyone who used software. In fact, that most people who use software use proprietary software, which means that horrible, painful restrictions were placed on them in using the software. We got a taste of what this was like when Xerox gave the MIT Artificial Intelligence Lab a laser printer. Now, this was a nice gift in some ways because it was the first time anybody outside Xerox ever had a laser printer. And it was really a high-speed office copier that had been modified into a printer. And this was very fast. It had high resolution and the straight lines came out straight and sharp. But it was also unreliable. It frequently got paper jams. Now, we knew what to do about that because our previous printer, which was slow and lower resolution and tended to make vertical lines waver a bit, also was unreliable. It would get paper jams or run out of things fairly often. And to cope with that situation, we couldn't make the printer itself work better, but we changed the software to compensate for the shortcomings of the printer. We were able to do this because that old printer was controlled by free software. We had the source code. We could make any changes we wanted to. And so we added a feature that any time a printout was finished, the system displayed a message for the user saying, your file foo has been printed, displayed on your screen right away. So you had to wait because the printer was slow, but you didn't have to wait extra just because you didn't know when the printout was finished. And then there was another feature which I recall I added myself, which was anytime the printer got in trouble, the system would display a message for each user currently waiting for printing, saying, the printer is in trouble, go fix it. Now, if you got that message, you would know that only a few people were going to get that message. So you couldn't just assume someone else will fix it, I don't have to go. You would go to the printer. So a minute or so after the printer would stop running, two or three people would arrive. At least one would know how to deal with the problem and would teach the others. And so the printer would get running again very soon. In effect, we treated the user as part of the system. We put in end-to-end feedback, and we obtained reliable operation for the system as a whole, even though the printer component was still unreliable. And that worked well. So when the new printer had similar problems, we wanted to solve them the same way. But then there we ran into a brick wall. You see, this printer was controlled by a special Xerox spooling computer running proprietary Xerox software. Xerox wouldn't let us have the source code for that software, so we were helpless to make changes in it. Even though we were as good programmers as you could have found anywhere, we couldn't do anything for that software. We were totally helpless. In effect, the whole AI lab was prisoners of its software because we were unable to change it to make it do what we needed. And this was very frustrating. So you type the commands to print a file, and a few seconds later it would say, your file foo has been spooled. Well, what else is new? It's always spooled in a few seconds unless the daemon's down. So at that point you go back to work. And a while later you notice the time. Oh, it's been half an hour. Nah, not long enough. You go back to work, and a while later you notice the time. Oh, it's been a whole hour. Maybe it's printed now. So you go upstairs to the printer, and you see it's been jammed the whole time. So at that point, you fix the jam, you go back to work, and a while later you notice the time. Oh, it's been another half hour. Maybe now it's printed. So you go back to the printer, and there you see it printed 300 pages of other people's stuff, which was around, that would have been around 5 minutes of printing, and jammed again. And at that point you say, I'm going to stand here and fix this damn printer every time it jams until my stuff comes out. So it was frustrating over and over. But what made it even more frustrating was to realize that we could have solved the problem, except that somebody in Xerox didn't want to let us solve the problem. Somebody was deliberately obstructing us, deliberately inflicting this frustration on us for some ends of his own. And so every time this happens, we have to be angry at those people with Xerox, as well as frustrated. It wasn't just the natural perversity of things. It was somebody's deliberate interference. Then I found out that somebody at Carnegie Mellon had a copy of that source code. Eventually, I visited Pittsburgh, so I went to his office and I said, I'm from the MIT AI lab. Could I have a copy of the printer software source code? And he said, no, I promised not to give you a copy. I was so angry, I couldn't think of a good way to express it, so I just turned and walked out without saying goodbye. Well, this was very bad for me and for the MIT AI lab, because we never got a copy of that source code, and it was frustrating to use that printer for as long as we had it. Goodbye. But in a paradoxical way, it was very good for me, because it taught me an important lesson. You see, that guy at Carnegie Mellon had promised to refuse to cooperate with us at MIT, but he didn't just do that to us. He probably did it to you too. And chances are, he did it to you too. And most likely, he did it to you too. In fact, he probably did it to most of the people in this room, except maybe some of you weren't born yet in 1981. And in fact, he did it to just, he promised not to cooperate, to refuse his help, to just about everybody in the world, because he had signed a non-disclosure agreement. The lesson I learned was, okay, this was my first experience, direct experience, with a non-disclosure agreement. I was the victim. I and my whole lab were the victims. And the lesson I learned was that non-disclosure agreements have victims. They are not innocent, harmless conveniences. They're doing somebody else wrong, maybe a lot of people. You don't know who. I promise that I will not help fill in the blank. Blank to be filled in later by circumstances. So you don't even know who you're betraying when you betray. It may be somebody you hate. It may be a stranger. It may be your best friend. You won't find out until the time comes. Most people first encounter a non-disclosure agreement when they're invited to sign one. And there's always some kind of temptation, some goodie you're going to get if you sign. And so people make excuses. They say to themselves, oh, I'm not really hurting anybody, and this is the way it's done, who am I to disagree, and they're never going to get this anyway, so why shouldn't I participate in depriving them, and if I don't do this, somebody else will. All the usual excuses and a few special ones. But when I was invited to sign a non-disclosure agreement, I had already learned what they really are. And I couldn't turn around and do to somebody else, somebody who probably was not going to be an enemy. Now, I had no reason to assume I would be hurting people who deserved it. They could be anybody. I had to assume they would not deserve to be hurt. what have you become if you start treating everybody at large as if they deserve to be hurt by you? So I was faced with doing to other people the same wrong that had been done to me and my whole lab. And I couldn't justify that to my conscience. So I said, thank you very much for offering me this nice software package, but I cannot in good conscience accept it on the terms you have offered. So I'm going to do without it. Thank you very much. And I have never knowingly signed a non-disclosure agreement for generally useful technical information, the kind of information which makes humanity better off, if it's available. Now, there are other kinds of information. If you wanted to talk with me about what was happening with your girlfriend and you asked me to please keep it a secret, I could do that, because that information is not generally useful information. It's probably not technical information either. Now, there may be related generally useful information, but the specific details are not generally useful. So that I could keep a secret for you if you wanted me to. But if some generally useful thing came out of it, like some wonderful new sex technique, I mean, it would be my duty. But you promised not to tell. I could only promise not to tell the details about you. So I wouldn't have to mention where I got it from. I wouldn't have to mention you at all. I could conceal that aspect. Although why you want me to conceal that? Wouldn't you want to be famous for it?
No!
Well, maybe if you had discovered it with somebody other than your girlfriend, maybe then I could understand why you want me to keep it quiet about you. But, although that brings up totally different ethical issues, you know, I don't believe in possessiveness about other people. That's not morally right. But the point is that there's a difference between personal information and generally useful technical information. As somewhere between a scientist and an engineer, the purpose of my work is to develop generally useful technical information and make it available. If I conceal it instead, I am betraying the mission of my field. So I have decided I will never do that. However, at about the same time that I had those experiences, a series of blows fell on the community I belonged to, which wiped it out in the end. And the ultimate blow was when Digital discontinued making the PDP-10. You see, our whole system, the system of software that we shared with anybody who wanted it, was started in the 1960s. It was written in assembler language. The only high-level language we had was Lisp. So, when it was written for one particular kind of computer, and when that was discontinued, the whole system was junk. It was useless. And the only way that you could get a modern computer back in, say, 1983 and use it was to get a proprietary operating system, which meant you had to sign a non-disclosure agreement. 1983 or so, yeah. What?
I rewrote CPM by then.
Maybe, but that didn't run on a real computer. I'm sorry, to me, you know, a 16-bit computer is just not a real computer. What can I say?
I'm 4-bit.
Ah.
I started 4W4.
Anyway, so that put me in a moral dilemma. Well, I mean, I guess conceivably I had the possibility, but of course, I couldn't keep working in my own field the way I had been doing it before, because that depended on being part of a community which no longer existed. So what were my alternatives? Well, I guess maybe I could have worked on these 4-bit computers, but that didn't appeal at all. Well, I could have gone along with the way things were changing. I could have started using non-free software and signing non-disclosure agreements, and I'm sure MIT would have had me start developing proprietary software, because lots of universities develop proprietary software. Don't think that proprietary software means commercial software. Those are two independent parameters. Well, I realized that if I did that, I could have fun coding, which I couldn't have done on a 4-bit computer. And I could have made money, especially if I left MIT and did it someplace else. But at the end of my career, I'd have to look back and say, I have spent all this time building walls to divide people. And I decided I couldn't ethically justify that, couldn't live with myself for doing that. So I decided to look for another alternative. And there was an obvious alternative. I could leave the field of computers, which would not have been too different from working on 4-bit computers. Now, many programmers don't seem to recognize that this is a possibility. They say, the employers who hire programmers demand this, this, and this. If I don't do those things, I'll starve. That's an exact quote. Well, even in the United States, even today, there are millions of people who make a living not from writing software. Now, I had no other special skills, but I'm sure I could have become a waiter. Not at a fancy restaurant, I suppose, but somewhere. Now, being a waiter, there's nothing unethical involved. And you're not going to starve. Think about that. But being a waiter would have been no fun for me, and it would have been wasting my skills, even though I would have avoided misusing them, I would still be wasting them. So I decided to look for another alternative. What could an operating system developer do that would actually make the world a better place, given this situation where the only operating systems available were proprietary? What if I wrote another operating system that wasn't proprietary? What if I wrote an operating system and said to everyone, share this, change this, you don't have to sign a non-disclosure agreement, go ahead and cooperate again? That could change the situation for everyone. So I realized that the skill of an operating system developer was exactly what was needed to open a third way to get everybody out of the moral dilemma that I was in. Now, this was a very big job, and I didn't know if it was possible to finish this job, developing a whole operating system. But at least it was worth trying, so I decided I would try to develop a free operating system. The next question was to make the major design decisions about the system. Well, I had just seen one system turn into junk because it was written for a particular model of computer that was discontinued. I didn't want that to happen again. So it was clear this system had to be portable. Well, at the time, I knew of one portable operating system that was actually a success, and that was Unix. Unix also had some good ideas. By the standards of the day, things like pipes and redirection and shell programming, the simple fork and exec system calls, were particularly good. So I decided to follow the design of Unix. And I decided also to be compatible with Unix. I realized this was important to make the system win acceptance from users. You see, I realized that if I had looked at the best ideas from the systems I had helped to develop and the other systems I had read about or used and put them all together with my own favorite ideas, I could have designed my own dream operating system. But I realized that if I showed that to users, they would say, well, this is very nice, but we've already written our programs to run on Unix, so we don't want to rewrite them. thanks, but we're not going to use it. Well, I wanted to create an alternative of freedom that people would really use and enjoy, not just make an excuse and say, well, I offered them freedom, they didn't take it, so don't blame me. So I realized compatibility was essential to achieve that goal. So I decided to make the system compatible with Unix, and that meant all the major design decisions were made. Because Unix consists of a large number of separate components that communicated using interfaces that were more or less documented. To be compatible meant using the same interfaces, which meant that the remaining design decisions mostly were within one particular component, and they didn't have to be made until somebody started writing that component. They didn't have to be made then. There was just one other major design decision, which was that I was not going to try to support 16-bit computers the way Unix mostly did. And the reason was that this was going to be a very big job. I had to try to make it easier. Now, when you're dealing with a computer with a small address space, the job becomes a lot harder. So I realized I could make the job easier by saying I insist on at least 32-bit computers. And I figured it would take several years to get a system running, and by then, 32-bit computers would be generally available, and that's what turned out to happen. So, all the design decisions were made. The next thing I needed was a name. The hackers always want to find funny or naughty names for things. And there's a hacker tradition that, you know, after all, your fun is off half the purpose at least, so you want to have fun with the name, too. So there's a hacker tradition that says when you're making a program that's like some existing program, you can give it a name which is a recursive acronym saying this program is not the other program. For example, in the 60s and 70s there were many Tico text editors, and most of them were called something or other Tico, but one clever hacker had the idea of calling his program Tint, for Tint is not Tico. The first recursive acronym. In 1975, I developed the first Emacs editor. That was followed by many more or less compatible Emacs-like editors. And most were called this Emacs or that Emacs or whoosie what's this Emacs. But one was called Fine for Fine is not Emacs. And there was Sign for Sign is not Emacs. And then there was Ina for Ina is not Emacs. Then Ina was almost completely rewritten. And the new version was called Zwei, for Zwei was Ina initially. So I decided to find a recursive acronym name, but it didn't take me more than a minute to discover that all the obvious four-letter possibilities were not particularly funny because they weren't words. So I tried I tried varying it a little bit, and I discovered that the word GNU, which is one of the greatest sources of humor in the English language, would work as a recursive acronym for this system if I made it stand for GNU is not Unix, just a simple contraction. By the way, when the dictionary says that the correct pronunciation is GNU, let me tell you what really happened. It's a loan word from an African language, and the original pronunciation has a click sound in it. Then the British arrived and colonized the place, and they didn't want to bother learning to pronounce click sounds. So they just said GNU, and they wrote it with a G to indicate there's something here we're not pronouncing. And then some other British people who were working on a dictionary said, well, British people say it this way and they write it this way, so those are both correct. Anyway, when it's the name of our operating system, please pronounce the hard G. Pronounce it GNU. Say it 1, 2, 3, GNU. Because if you call it the new operating system, you'll get people very confused. We've been working on it for 16 years now. It's not new anymore, but it still is and always will be GNU. So, we had a name Next thing was to look for funding. I wrote a description of the project, addressed to computer manufacturers, saying, you are spending millions of dollars a year on units license fees. How about if you contribute $50,000 to this project? If you do that and a few other companies do that, there is a substantial chance that starting a few years from now, we will save you, you know, 100 times what you spent. And some executives started out by being interested, but there was no useful follow-up. So after a few months, I gave up on that, and I said, never mind the funding. I don't want to spend years waiting around accomplishing nothing except trying and failing to get money. I'm going to start writing the code instead. So I announced the project to the public, and then in January 1984, I quit my job at the MIT Artificial Intelligence Lab to start the Beam project. Now, I had to quit my job because universities have been known to take the software developed by their staff and turn them into proprietary software products. Now, my purpose in writing this software was not just to advance technology or to have a success. I was working to give people freedom. And if the software, if the freedom was interfered with by MIT, that would defeat the whole purpose. I had to make sure that wouldn't happen. The only way to do that was to quit the job and take MIT out of the equation. So I went into Professor Winston's office, and he said, do you still want to quit? And I said, yes. And he said, do you want to keep your key? Okay. So I started developing GNU using MIT's Unix machine. And this was actually the first time I ever used Unix. So I was never a Unix wizard the way some other people were. And I never got to see what Unix was really like until I started the GNU project. And fortunately, I started discovering at that point some of its flaws and deficiencies. But fortunately, most of them were reparable. There were a few ways in which it was actually a step backward from the other systems I was used to, which we can't repair because it would be an incompatible change and it would cause more harm from the incompatibility than it would do good from the superiority. So we're stuck with it. Like the fact that when you rewrite a file, first it truncates the file to zero length, and then it starts writing stuff into it, and if anybody reads the file during that time, they get an inconsistent who knows what. Not very clean, you know. Back in 1970, people knew how to do better than that. Anyway, at that point, I thought that I and other people would join together, we'd write piece after piece, and eventually we'd have a whole system, and we'd say, come and get it. And then people would start using it. That's not what happened. In September 1984, I started working on GNU Emacs, which was my second implementation of Emacs. By early 1985, it was working well enough that I could actually use it to do all my editing, which was nice because it meant I could actually edit on the Unix machine where I was doing the compilation. I had no intention of learning to use VI. So until that time, I did my editing on other computers and saved the files across the network. Well, when Emacs was good enough for me to edit with, it was good enough for lots of people to edit with, so people started asking for copies. And that meant I had to work out the details of distribution. Of course, I put a copy into the anonymous FTP directory, and that was good for people who were on the network. But in 1985, even most programmers were not on the net. So the question was, what would I say to them when they asked for copies? I could have said, I want to spend my time coding, writing more of GNU, not writing tapes. So find a friend who's on the net who will download it for you and put it on a tape for you. And I think most of them would have found somebody who could do that for them. But I had no job, and I was looking for a way I could make some money from free software. So I announced, send me $150 and I'll mail you a tape of Emacs. So I started a free software business. Now, some people say to me, what do you mean it's free software if it costs $150? Well, the English language has more words than any other, but it has some, still has some strange, inaccountable deficiencies. And one of them is that we've got one word, free, for several meanings. One meaning of free refers to price, another refers to freedom. When I say free software, I'm talking about freedom, not price. So think of free speech, not free beer. I realize that may be hard for college students, but make an effort. It's good for you. Freedom is good for you, and beer isn't really. So, some people got their copies of Emacs by copying it over the net and didn't pay me anything. Others got their copies by paying me money for a tape. Others got their copies from friends and didn't pay me anything. Maybe they paid their friends something, but probably not. You know, if you just made a few copies occasionally for your friends, you wouldn't ask them to pay you. You'd do it as a favor. So some people paid money and some didn't. But all of them got the same freedoms, and that's the important thing. You see, I didn't start the free software movement because I want programmers to get less money. I don't mind when I get paid money, so why should I mind if you get paid money? It's the same ethical situation, whether it's you or me. The issue here is to have freedom. I want to have freedom, and I want you to have freedom. The people who got copies of Emacs had certain crucial freedoms. And so let me now give the definition of free software. A program is free software for you, a particular user, if you have the following freedoms. Freedom 0, the freedom to run the program for any purpose. Freedom 1, the freedom to help yourself by changing the program to suit your needs. Freedom 2, the freedom to help your neighbor by distributing copies of the program. And freedom 3, the freedom to help build your community by making improvements and publishing them so that other people can get the benefit of your work. If you have all of those freedoms, the program is free software for you. Now, freedom 0 doesn't require too much discussion because most software gives you freedom 0. So any program which does not give you freedom 0 is particularly restrictive. And also, legally, freedom 0 follows as a consequence of freedoms 1, 2, and 3. So, I won't say much more about freedom 0. I'll go on to freedom 1, the freedom to help yourself by making the changes that you need. This could mean fixing bugs, could mean adding features. Either way, in order for freedom 1 to be effective, you have to have the source code. If you don't have the source code, then even the most trivial changes, like using 4 digits instead of 2 digits for a year, are nearly impossible. And by the way, not having source code was one of several major factors contributing to the difficulty of the Y2K upgrade and the expense of it. Now, freedom number 1 is important. It's obviously useful to anybody who's a programmer. It's also useful to any businesses that use software. If you're using software in your business, then even if you're not a programmer and nobody in the company is a programmer, if you need something changed, you can go and hire a programmer to do it. The same as if you need the walls in your office moved, well, maybe nobody in your company is a carpenter, but you can hire one. Free software, this freedom, the freedom to change the software, is also useful even to people who are not going to make the changes themselves and are not going to pay somebody to. For one thing, you may have a friend who is willing to make a small change for you. And even if you don't, somebody else may share the same desires you have and may decide to make that improvement. And then it may become available to you to use as a result. So this freedom potentially benefits everyone, And I should also mention that while most people surely will not learn to become good programmers, really learn the skill of programming, anybody can learn a little bit of programming, and sometimes you need a small change made. Sometimes a small change can make things a lot more convenient. So for a large number of people, they will be able to make use of this freedom in some ways, even if not in all ways, directly. Now, I've already explained what it's like not to have this freedom, how it causes practical material harm. It makes you a prisoner of your software. But in addition, it causes a kind of psychosocial harm. It damages people's morale, their enthusiasm for their work. When you have to do your work using something that has been set up to be hard to use by somebody who's callous and doesn't care, to protect yourself from frustration, you must stop caring about whether you get work done or not. That's the only way, the only response people will make, unless they have a tremendous reason and tremendous mental strength. And most jobs, most people don't have the mental strength, and most jobs don't give you the reason to use it if you have it. So it leads to people having an attitude like, well, I showed up for work today. Whether I can get anything done, that's not my problem. And that's not good for society or for the people involved. So that's freedom one, the freedom to help yourself. Freedom two is the freedom to help your neighbor by redistributing copies of the program. The fundamental act of friendship for beings that can think and learn is to teach each other. When you teach somebody else, when you share knowledge and useful information with someone else, you can give something without losing it yourself. When these beings use computers, this fundamental act takes the form of sharing software and other useful materials that are on the computer. If you don't have the freedom to engage in this fundamental act of freedom, that causes practical material harm. It causes the software to be wasted. If the program has an owner who, by any means, it doesn't matter what means is used, establishes a situation where every user must pay to use the program, the result is that some users will say, all right, I'll pay, and other users will say, never mind, I'll do without it. And every time somebody says, never mind, I'll do without it, the program is going partly to waste. Somebody who would have wanted to use it is being discouraged from using it. You see, this price causes a financial disincentive discouraging people from using the program. And it works. It has an effect. It causes some people not to use the program. However, the work it takes to develop the program to any given level of power and quality is the same regardless of the number of users. So you do the same work. It does only a part of the good. That is deliberately inflicted waste. So that's practical material harm. But because it is deliberately inflicted practical material harm, it also causes psychosocial harm, which affects the spirit of goodwill, which is the fundamental resource of society. It's the difference between a society and a dog-eat-dog jungle. The fact that people have goodwill, at least many people do, for a large part of the circumstances they can favor they're asked for, except for some women, I guess. But that's a whole different political issue there. But all of us will do some of the favors we're asked for. When it's not too hard, when it's important, we do favors for other people, or at least most of us do. And the ones who are exceptions are a real pain in the neck. If you ever have to deal with somebody whose attitude all the time is, what's in it for me? That's no fun. Now, this spirit of goodwill is such an important resource of society that we make efforts to spread it and encourage it and teach it. So what does it mean when the governments and other powerful institutions start telling everybody, if you share software with your friend, that's evil, that's stealing? What does that do to this resource our society depends on? And what happens when the government says, if you share with your neighbor, that means you're a pirate and will put you in jail? How much fear is it going to take to convince people not to share with their friends? Do you want to live in a society permeated by that level of fear? I don't want it to get there. And that's why freedom number two is so important. Well, of course, there are other theories that say it's not important. One other theory said central planning was the answer. If you tell everybody what job to do and how to do it, then society will function and everybody will work together and it will go smoothly. Well, people generally believe that theory was a failure. There's another alternative theory that if everybody is greedy and cares only about direct advantage, that's through enlightened self-interest, people will negotiate contracts and that will make everything work smoothly. I guess you could call this the worship of the invisible hand. Well, if you look around at the places like the United States where this has been tried, it's a failure too. Although a few people were benefiting from it and they like to go around paying the media to say it's a success. But basically, it's a failure. It's been a failure for most Americans since Reagan started trying it. Most Americans now have to work harder just to make the same pay since 1981. So basically, if we want a livable society, we must have this resource of goodwill. Now, it's interesting to compare the measures that are being used to try to stop people from sharing copies with their neighbors. Because the U.S. is not the first country to attempt to stop people from redistributing useful and important information. The Soviet Union did this too. They went to great lengths to try to stamp out private, unauthorized copying of information, which was known as samizdat. And how did they do this? Well, there were five basic mechanisms. One was harsh punishments for anyone caught. And two, they looked for informers. They tried to convince everyone to inform on their co-workers and friends. And I forgot to mention, really number one is to guard all the copiers. Every copier in the Soviet Union had to have a guard watching what was copied. Then we have the others are two and three. And four is collective responsibility. You're supposed to watch all of them. If I catch any of them with illegal copying, you're going to prison. And five was propaganda starting in childhood to teach people that only monsters would ever engage in this kind of forbidden copying. All of these five methods have been proposed and many even put into use in the U.S. at the request of media companies through the actions of their agents, the U.S. government. Guards on copying equipment, that's part of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Of course, in the U.S., since human labor is expensive, they don't require human guards. The idea is to use robot guards to require robot guards in your computer and make it a crime to turn them off. So you're not free to program your computer anymore either. And harsh penalties. Until a few years ago, non-commercial copying of copyrighted works and distributing them to your friends, not getting anything in exchange, was not a crime at all. Now it's a felony. This is more important than sticking knives at people on the street, you know, because the software owners are more important than you. And looking for informers. In Boston last summer, there were ads in the subways asking people to turn informer, turn stool pigeon, and call the Software Publishers Association. And collective responsibility, well, in the U.S., the method being used is internet service providers. Every time an internet service provider gets a complaint, they have to take the materials down within 14 days. They have to do this every time, or else they are directly liable for everything that there's a complaint about. So it's very effective enforcement, and it's even being used to hush up embarrassing internal documents from companies about how they're cheating the public. There's an article by Brian Pfaffenberger, I think it's in Linux Journal or something like that, about it, about how Ford Motor Company did this. Somebody leaked some documents about how they knew about defects in some cars and posted it on the internet. Their website's been taken down. They can't get this information out to the public anymore. Really convenient for any company that wants to swindle the public and endanger the public. Oh, and the last thing, propaganda, starting in childhood. When I went to kindergarten, the teachers were trying to teach us to share, you know, inculcate this goodwill that society needs. So if you brought any candy to school, they would say, you can't just eat it all yourself, you've got to share it with the other kids. Nowadays, according to the administration, they're supposed to teach the kids to say yes to licensing. Their words. So if you bring some software, no, don't share the software. Sharing is wrong. Sharing means you're a pirate. Sharing is no good for the media companies and the software companies, and they're more important than living in a good society. So this is why I consider freedom number two to be the social reasons for freedom number two are the most important reason why software should be free. But moving on now to freedom number three, the freedom to help build your community. That is the freedom to make an improvement in the software and publish it so that other people can use it, and then they can build further improvements on top of it. Now, many people said to me in the past, if the software is free, nobody will get paid to work on it, so why would anybody work on it? Well, nowadays we can compare that theory with empirical facts and find out that both halves of the argument are wrong. A number of people do get paid to write free software, and B, lots of people work on improving software with free software without getting paid. In fact, there's people who have noted a phenomenon that when a free program catches on, it tends to get lots of people working on it. For instance, when I released GNU Emacs in 1985, people started sending me bug fixes and new packages to add new features, and more bug fixes and more new features and more and more and more, so they were pouring in on me so much that merely to do the work to digest all of their help was a big job. Microsoft doesn't have that problem. And there are people who have noted this phenomenon and pointed out that free programs that catch on tend to become very powerful and very reliable. And they argued that software should be free, or more precisely, that users should have these freedoms, simply to get powerful, reliable software. Those people call themselves the open source movement. Now, the open source movement was founded 2 years ago, and it avoids mentioning these issues about freedom and what kind of society we want to live in. In fact, they avoid it like the plague. And instead, they argue for about the same conclusions using practical benefits only. Now, I agree with that position as far as it goes, but I think that we must talk about things that go beyond these practical benefits. Having powerful, reliable software is a good thing, but it's not the only important thing about our lives. We mustn't stop talking about what freedom we want to have, what kind of community we want to be part of. So this is where the free software movement differs from the open source movement. In the free software movement, we put those issues, those deeper issues, front and center. Because there's more than just practical convenience at stake here. Now, if you don't have freedom number three, the freedom to publish improved versions, then practical material harm results because this process of improvement can't go on. But in addition, there is psychosocial harm, which affects the spirit of scientific cooperation. The awareness that we can develop human knowledge more effectively if we work together rather than against each other. The spirit of scientific cooperation once was so strong that scientists cooperated sometimes even when their countries were at war. I read that U.S. Marines landing on an island in the Pacific Ocean during World War II found a building with a note on it. The note was addressed to them. It said, "This is a marine biology lab. Please take care of our specimens and our notes. We put them in order because we want American scientists to continue our work." The note was written by Japanese scientists. And even though their country was at war with our country, they didn't want that to obstruct the progress of biology. They didn't care if it was American or Japanese scientists who finished up their work and made it feed into the future developments of biology, as long as it didn't get lost. But today, it's as if every little band of scientists and engineers is at war with every other little band, trying to hold them back and keep them in the dark. It's like gang warfare within our society. And I don't see why we should allow that kind of gang warfare to continue. So those are the three freedoms that distinguish free software from most software, and the six reasons why they're important. These reasons led me to the conclusion that all published software should be free, that all software users are entitled to these freedoms and should never be asked to give them up. Now, I've defined the term free software with reference to a particular arbitrarily chosen user. I did this for a reason. Because sometimes whether a program is free depends on which user you pick. Now that might seem strange, so let me illustrate with an example. The biggest example of this is the X Window system, which was developed at MIT and released by that group as free software. If you got the software from MIT, then that made it free software. That meant you had these freedoms. So it was free software for you. But among those who got the software from MIT were various computer manufacturers that distributed Unix systems. They changed, maybe 1% of the code, maybe that which might have been a few thousand lines, to make the X run on their system, and put it into their Unix system and distribute it under the same non-disclosure agreement, distributing binaries only to their customers. So for their customers, X Windows was not free software. What they got was proprietary software, user subjugating software in the same way as Unix was. So this led to a paradoxical situation where if you ask the question, is X free software or not, the question depended on where you made the measurement. If you made the measurement coming out of the developers group, you'd say, yeah, over here I observe all the crucial freedoms. Over here it's free software. If you looked at the average of the users, you know, on the average, what freedoms does a user of this software have? Typically it was not free software for most of them. Most of them didn't have any of those freedoms. Now, the people who developed X didn't mind this because their goal was to have a big success. You know, to develop a Windows system that would advance the state of the art and would set a standard and become popular. Well, it did those things, and they were happy. But I had a different goal. I was working to give computer users freedom. And if the same thing that happened to X were to happen to GNU, it would make GNU a failure. So I developed a method of stopping this from happening, and that method is called copyleft. You can think of copyleft as being copyright flipped over. The idea is, first I say this program is copyrighted, which means by default it's prohibited to copy it or redistribute it or change it. But then I say you can modify it, and you can copy it, and you can redistribute it. You can even distribute the modified copies with a condition. When you distribute any copies, whether you verbatim or modified or enlarged, you must do it under precisely these terms, no more and no less. So whoever gets the copies from you gets the same freedoms that you got from me. So as copies of the program spread around, the freedom goes with them. Nobody can strip off the freedom and make a restricted user enslaving binary and distribute that. Or at least we can sue them if they do, and maybe even get them prosecuted. So, in effect, copyleft creates inalienable rights. These fundamental freedoms that define free software become inalienable rights for the users of that software. And that's my goal, because these should be the inalienable rights of anybody using published software. But I can't legally change that for all software, but I can, using copyleft, try to set it up for the software that I write. Now, copyleft is a general idea, like, you know, compiler is a general idea. You can't run the general idea of compiler. You have to have a specific compiler written in order to run that. Likewise, to use copyleft, you need a specific implementation. The particular implementation of copyleft that we use for most software in the GNU project is called the GNU General Public License. That's a particular license written in legal law, which we put on most of our software. There are a couple of other forms of copyleft that we use for certain other pieces of software. And then there are other forms of copyleft that we use for documentation. And right now, I'm developing a more sophisticated copyleft for free software. which